As communities evolve, how might museums adapt to reflect their needs, voices, and stories? This year's International Museum Day celebrates the theme, The Future of Museums in Rapidly Changing Communities, a powerful call to rethink how museums can stay relevant, resilient, and responsive in the face of social, environmental, and technological changes. Continuing this global dialogue, this theme will also take center stage at the upcoming ICOM General Conference this November, a major global gathering where museum professionals, cultural workers, and thought leaders come together to shape what's next for our field. Registrations are now open, and all details can be found at ICOM.museum. This is your chance to join a worldwide conversation about the evolving role of museums. Today, we're thrilled to welcome the designers, architects, and artists Katarina Bonvier and Therese Christiansson, founders of MIKET, the Swedish art and architecture collective, a group whose work weaves together performance, architecture, activism, and community building. Through many of their projects, MIKET reclaims public and museum spaces as sites of inclusion, joy, protest, and transformation. We will explore how their work speaks to some of the key sustainable development goals selected for this International Museum Day, SDG 8, by supporting local economies through creative employment and education, SDG 9, by fostering innovation and embracing new technologies to engage diverse audiences, and SDG 11, by imagining more inclusive and resilient urban features where culture and heritage are central. Let's dive into this conversation about queering space, crafting community, and the radical potential of museums to shape better futures. Welcome, MIKET, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. I mean, it's so fantastic to be here and also to hear about your approach to this idea of museum and chill. We really love it. Okay, so we are a group, a collective of three persons, and we've been working together since 2012. And we came together because we wanted to show what we talked about, because prior to working, like now we work very much hands-on and we're doing large-scale installation and different shape givings. And before we were working as educators in various schools, institutions. And we were talking a lot about feminist perspectives on architecture and spaces and queer perspectives and interrace perspectives and class perspectives and all of these different perspectives that come together to try to create more just space or more equal spaces. And our students kept on asking us, but what does it look like? What would it look like when you did it or when you do it? And that question kept on bugging us. And then Therese asked me, you know, Katarina, maybe you and I and Mariana should work together and see what happens. So we just started. It was like an infatuation. We really started, it was like a love relation that started there. Mm. And then since then we've been working and trying to like actually create spaces that you can enter that are based on these values that we came together.
How do you see this work when you have to reach out to communities, because what I've seen is that you reach out to a lot of local communities to be able to put the work in the space that you're looking at. So how does that looks like when you think of the project and you have to reach out to a community?
I guess they look very different from each other, or maybe in some way maybe you can see a sort of style also, but for us they look very different since we try to involve people and that the outcomes and that everyone's involvement somehow will be visible in the outcome. At the same time, we're in charge, of course, and we have to lead and take responsibility for the design and the design process and the outcome and that it will be taken care of and etc. We try to start with pretty open-ended outcomes where we usually do stuff together. So we take in materiality and test and try out through doing things together from the start. And then some kind of we weave it into a bigger blanket.
We really believe that aesthetics is a question of accessibility and that it relates to accessibility. And if we use the same aesthetics over and over again, it will be the same group of people who are all the time called into this space. So for instance, we did a long research project about the queer club scene And then we did an array of various spaces. Some one was like the aesthetic was super in your face, you know, like we're here, it's like neon, it's very strong colors, very like in your face. And then we made another club that was super subtle and silky and all just the lovely things. So, and they're quite aesthetically quite different. They would also invite, like you would behave different in those spaces. So I think one big part of our work together is to explore also the power of aesthetics and how aesthetics is tied to ethics. And when we, for instance, we made this dance floor together with a dance group called Mixed Dancers in Roslet in Jönköping in southern Sweden. And they had a particular purple color that was their signature color. And they are, the dances that they're developing are like street dances. And one of their biggest features is the ball cap. So we just said, like, maybe we should make a giant ball cap. And they'd loved it. So we made a giant ball cap. And I love it, but it's, you know, as a designer, it's not really, I mean, it's very slapstick architecture, you know, it's like, it's a ball cap, wow, and it works, and it's their signature, and it's, so it really tells the community that, you know, this is a particular, it's a way of celebrating that dance group, and then, of course, that public space is open for everyone, it's just that it has the celebration of the mixed dancer dance group built into it. So we try to be very specific with the aesthetics.
I ask about this because when it comes to, in our perspective from museums, when it comes to working with local communities, it's often a conversation of how the work with the community starts and then how it evolves so that they can also feel like the space, it's representing them and it's inviting them. Because museums, they are so different from each other as well, and they can give so different spaces that might not necessarily align sometimes with as you're saying, maybe the color that is chosen by the project or just an object that represents the culture. That for us it's super interesting to see how it's explored to integrate objects, tones, music, sounds, just generally to exhibitions that museums can then display. And even if the architectural space is different, it can still be welcoming to the community and to people around that might want to learn more or might want to interact, which is where my other question comes in. When it comes to, as you said at the beginning, as teachers, you see the value of educational components in your projects, I will probably guess. And my question is, how do you see then components such as workshops or participatory design empower communities and foster creativity agency?
Okay, so we did this huge installation, like 300 square meter installation for the Architecture Museum of the National Museum of Norway. And they asked us to create a queer, they wanted us to make a queer exhibition. And the first thing we did there was, I mean, we've tried to queer the architecture in many different ways, like physically, materially. But that also goes hand in hand with the people who are working there, the audience that is going to come there. And so we tried to find out, like, what is the kind of, is there any queer culture already in the museum? And we found some like key, like peer figures there. So for instance, I mean, the most clear example is Paulo Araya, or he's really involved in the drag community in Oslo, and also like a drag teacher, and he has his drag family, and he's a drag mom, right? Mm. Yeah. And he, for the museum, he works in the reception and with pedagogy. So we immediately had a kind of peer person in the museum that could, you know, help us also see how we could develop the exhibition into a queer space by the help of the activities that took place there. So for instance, he then developed a poster workshop that we could, and the posters would put up into the exhibition. So I think also that influenced the aesthetics of the exhibition, that became much more drag in the exhibition than it would have been without him. Mm-hmm. And then we also got connection with the, like the queer
ballroom scene.
The ballroom scene.
Yeah, so they, exactly. So that was another key person at the National Museum. So we could involve different parts of that community to come and use the space. So they had performance, and that also shaped the aesthetics of the exhibition. We tried to dig where we stand or where we get invited. We dig where we get invited, and then we take it from there to try to build up something that will be useful for for the community or parts of the community.
And it's also interesting because we come up with lots of proposals, but then of course when you're in an actual factual world, there are all these limits to what you can do. And one interesting thing with a museum, I think that's common in many museums, that is that the architecture is almost holy, that it's so important that you can't touch it, even though it's built to become a museum building. So that was also interesting, because if you want to queer something that is so static, that is so monumental, how do you do that? And what can you touch in this? What walls can you come up to, and what can you do with those walls? And for us, it's a lot about tactility and how you approach the architecture also in a very physical way, and to find out where the limits were in relation to that. And also that particular building is like designed by one of the most patriarchal geniuses of Norwegian architecture, Sverre Fehien, is like the grand, you know, and how do you queer Sverre Fehien's work, you know? So there are lots of really interesting discussion in relation to community work. Mm-hmm. And for us, it would be so strange to make this kind of meta exhibition about queer culture without the queer community, you know, then that would just be, a freak show. So somehow we need to involve the community. But I think one of our first ideas was to switch the time for opening so that it would only be open in the nights and closed all day. You know, that would queer it completely immediately.
It's hard to organize. Yeah. But I was thinking the question was also about educating, right? So I'm thinking because we usually we have an artistic research project also ongoing all the time. And as part of that also, we're kind of obliged to share our research. And we do research a lot on aesthetics and pedagogy, you could say. So while also working with the institutions, I think we see the entire process as educational, not only in relation to specific groups or visitors, but also the museum organization itself, kind of, in doing otherwise, or and how you can involve employees who shift their positions. Since also, I mean, the private or the personal is political. I mean, that's where we come from. That you'll also take your backgrounds, your gender, your sexuality, all these things that you come with and that is maybe not pronounced, we actually kind of support that, we make that visible in the museum space. So I think a lot of our work is negotiating kind of and educating maybe the institution that we're working with as well. Mm-hmm. And it works, of course, the best when they're also eager to engage in this process.
It's super interesting to see a perspective of starting from the inside of the museum in a way, rather than coming in with something that's not considering the space or the people. It's super interesting to hear that, because it's, I guess, I don't know how many times you've encountered this type of approach, but for me it's something new and it's something refreshing in a way, because we do have a lot of people at museums that already, as you were mentioning, can bring a lot of substance to the project that you might be able to explore, or the museum is asking you to find ways to implement. So that's incredibly valuable. And then, as you were mentioning, in terms of the space, I was wondering how much of the space, now that we have so many different technologies, how much you consider it using technologies as well when you want to intervene in spaces that, as you were saying, might not be as flexible in terms of adding textiles or just adding objects or paints or any material in itself. How would you then include technologies within your experience? How does that work? Is it something that can still embody the same meaning or the same impact? Or is it something that changes completely the idea behind the exhibition or the project in itself?
Well, I mean, technologies is a wide term, right? So we are really in the current research project that we're doing called Troll Perceptions in the Heartlands, we are digging out forgotten technologies from the past and like building technologies and trying to apply them now as also means to contribute to the system shift that we need to do in relation to, you know, what the state of the planet. And for instance, so we have we've been very interested in clay, for instance, and how you can use clay for constructions. And well, one very concrete example was when we were working with an exhibition called Vi är rika som troll in Swedish. That means we are rich as trolls. And trolls, I need to explain that that's a fantastic, imaginary, or very true figure that lives in the woods or in the rocks in Scandinavia, in the northern parts of this, well, in these geographies that where we are active. And all the stories about trolls, they come from a time when people in this region lived much closer to nature or much more subordinated to the forces of nature, which we are still, of course, but we try to forget that we are. Anyway, I'm generalizing, but just to paint the picture. And anyway, so what we could do in Katrineholm was that we brought out this technology of clay paint. So you can make really beautiful zero-cost paint out of clay and water and some glue. And we tried it out on the walls of the art hall, the art exhibition hall. And what happened then, it was really fantastic to be able to try out that in full scale. And then the next step was actually, this relates to your last question also, director of that exhibition hall then took that technology into a big workshop they had together with all the other museums and cultural institutions in the region. So they taught in the next step how to create this or to paint with clay paint, which is a super sustainable and non-poisonous and conserving. I mean, it's like a really beautiful material. So, but I think we were asking about technologies. You meant more like technologies but based on electricity, right?
But this is a good. I think it's good starting. Yeah. I mean, it's one technology, but we've been working pretty much with animation and projections and tried out virtual realities and augmented realities. We think it's really interesting to work with that too. Although I think we are also tired of things that are required and necessary to make that work, actually, to have a really good augmented reality project or virtual reality project is also about resources. So, but we do blend it in because it is, I'm thinking of, we made a dance floor at the museum, at Nationalmuseet for Heaven. So how do we stage a dance floor when we're not going to be there with our bodies? And when a museum visitor comes all alone, how can they get the feeling of never being alone on the dance floor, right? We want to give them this empowering queer dance floor feeling. So there we could work with parallel projections that were always dancing, and you moved through this space with lots of floating fabric and dancing figures kind of. So there was really, so we do use, and we work always with an animator also.
And with sound.
And with
which
sound,
is also really interesting technology-wise. So we work, because that's also, sound is of course a very beautiful way of creating a space. Mm. Like the dance floor, which Therese just described, we also had a composer create a sound for that dance floor, which was particular for that dance floor. So it really became an immersive experience to enter. Mm. And funny, because this dance floor was in the middle of the exhibition, but you couldn't find it. It was sort of like hidden. So you had to walk like zigzag or find your way into it. But you could hear it. You'd hear the sound of the dance floor, like, going through the walls, but like you had to like be curious and find your way into it, which was also very fun to create like this. And that was also a way to, like we talked about before, queer the architecture, because like the center of the exhibition was hidden.
But I actually agree with Therese on the fact that both perspectives of technologies in terms of electricity, but technologies as well of like practices and as you mentioned first, Katarina, of like forgotten technologies, it's something that I don't think we question a lot. So thank you for bringing that up as well, which is incredibly valuable. And actually, I wanted to mention your project, that thank you for mentioning it so that I now know sort of how to pronounce it. So projects like Utsikten and Verika som Troll suggest a deep interest in sustainability and inclusive urban development. If we translate this to museums, how do you see the idea of museums and public art spaces as part of a sustainable society, a sustainable space?
I mean, they're... I guess So in relation to, we can start with Utsikten at the Arktis, the Center for Architecture and Design in Stockholm. I mean, it's a perfect place for education, right? And they're also, I mean, they're investing a lot in education, so they will have open workshops every day except for Mondays all summer for kids. And I'm thinking that the resources they have and the knowledge should be centers for example, bringing these old or main or also partially forgotten technologies that are sustainable technologies out to the public, since they have such a often great position already in society. They're well known, they reach out to a lot of people, so they really have the chance to be hubs for experimentation and education, right? And we have a other fantastic example in Sweden, Sörmlands Museum. So it's a regional museum, and they are really invested into giving workshops in weaving techniques, clay wall building, clay house building. And that's really very well embedded in their practice.
And also, interestingly, they're connected to contemporary art.
Yes.
So it's not like,
Not only conservation or something of preserving old architectures or old art pieces for renovation and restoration, but using them as sustainable technologies for the future.
So it's it's a fun, it's a beautiful way of like activist heritage somehow. with art. And I think
And they manage to, their workshops are fully booked like this quick. You have to really know when they release. So I'm thinking that you can see some institutions struggling with visitors or a breadth of visitors, wanting different groups in society maybe to come there that they don't reach out to. Then you'll have to think about, okay, how do you reach out with what interests different groups? So you'll have to have a pretty broad variety of maybe crafts. I'm also thinking we had a workshop. We are growing calabas, for which is a fantastic crop which you can eat and you can make a design out of, and inviting people to grow it, to harvest it, and then working it into pieces for holding water or liquids or lampshades or whatever. And that will of course attract a certain group of interestees, whereas other techniques, clay paint, might appeal to others, etc. So I think through these different learning options, you'll also get a broader variety of visitors to the museum.
Yeah, I could also add, like, for an example, because you can also, of course, propose it to a group that would never be, attracted to it. For instance, at Utsikten, which means the view in English, Utsikten, we were working together with another research project that are looking at the future of transportation systems in Sweden, roads and, the big infrastructural questions. And this group of researchers, they came to our installation, and they were helping us harvesting the calabas, the bottle gourds. And of course, they weren't there because of the bottle gourds, but they got them as the workshop. And while we harvested them and prepared them for the winter, when the next step in the process is to dry them, to hang them up to dry, and they all had to prepare like a little braid to hang them in and so on. And during doing that, I mean, having your hands working on something while talking about the future of the infrastructure of Sweden, this is like the big governmental board that was there. And I think that made the discussion completely different. And perhaps not in an intellectual way, but in a very like sensible way. And I think we could talk about it in like how the discussion went. Sitting there braiding and understanding the fantastic crop that is this gourd, and talking about the future of the infrastructure. You know, that just made the conversation completely different.
Yes, I mean, it's in a way, it's always about exploration and as you mentioned before, about testing and experimenting to see where we go and to see how it really involves all the actors involved in terms of museums, artists, spaces, just generally cultural spaces. So in that sense, as inclusion is a central key part of your practice, especially in terms of in relation to queer, anti-racist and feminist perspectives, what role do you think museums can play in building more resilient and inclusive communities?
Large role. Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's so, there's so many, this is a big question, but I really, really believe that, I mean, also you both think about like the actual museum as a place you can come to and you can meet and you can share that space, which is, you know, foundational. And also, of course, the collections that museums keep and how they are activated and what they can tell us. I mean, like, for instance, this idea of the museum collection as a kind of climate archive, because the items might have been collected for one reason. But now when we look at these items, the stories they can tell can be very different from the reason why they were collected. Like we can take the bottle gourd again. I know there are bottle gourds in the collection of the National Museum in Sweden, and they are from the 18th century. How did they get to the museum, and where did they grow, and why were they brought to the museum? You know, so it also tells the story of colonialism. It tells a story about how species have been traveling across the globe, and where they can grow, where they could grow then and where they can grow now in relation to climate change. So there are lots of different other stories that you can tell with items that has been collected, you know. Okay, so more museums. It's a broad question.
I'm thinking of that. There was a prime time of the Modern Museum in Stockholm, usually talked about as the prime time, I guess, when there were Ararat, the Finnish collective, also like living building structures, living in the museum. And you had Niki de Saint-Phal and Jean Tanguy building this huge chic cathedral. People could walk in and hang out. And they were like, somehow spaces were a little bit, they were open-ended for using in discussion, and I think there were pretty big political discussions, the museum kind of dared to do this, to lose a little bit control, to take the discussion, and in retrospect, it's regarded as a super important period of time, so it could really work as inspiration of how to move forward in using the spaces in different ways, even inviting collectors to live in the museums, etc.
It was a broad question, and the next one, it's a bit similar, but it's our last question. So if you could imagine the ideal museum of the future, what would it look like, or what would it look, sound, or feel like?
Okay, so it would have 24, it would be open 24 hours for sure. And there need to be people there who are like keeping the space. So it needs to be, and I think it also should be open to other species. So of course, all the other organisms that are here should be welcome. And what more? Of course, it would probably be quite nice if it could just be a takeover of an existing building. That could be maybe a ruin in one side and a new construction in the other end. So it could be a continuous, like showing how actually everything is in a continuum and everything is always moving. Because we do tend to think that some things are stable. And we need to think, I think when I say they, I mean humans, we kind of need some kind of stability, and the building is just staying there. But so we need that, but we also need that it's under constant movement somehow, and bring that out. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
And food?
Food. And I wish it would smell, I mean, growing different things, both for humans and pollinators and animals, and taking care of water, and it should smell really good of plants and food, of course, food is important.
It sounds like a culture house.
Oh,
I guess something.
You know, and somehow, I guess, a little rowdy in the sense that consensus usually is some form of oppression. That it will, if different people's voices and opinions would be heard, it has to be a space where there can be collision as well. Of course, respectful collision, but nonetheless. And I think any, as Katarina said, any existing place can just transform and start doing this. We don't need to build anything new. We shouldn't build anything new because everything is already built. We can't build anything new. We just transform what we have, right?
From our side, it's the end of our conversation. So thank you, Miguel, for joining us today and sharing your powerful insights into how creativity, collaboration, and critical imagination can shape the museums of tomorrow. Your work truly embodies the spirit of this year's International Museum Day, the future of museum in rapidly changing communities. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
This conversation also feels especially meaningful as we head into Pride Month, a time to honor and celebrate queer culture and activism, values that are deeply embedded in Miket's practice. Thanks again for listening to Museums of Chill, and until the next time.